Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, May 6th. For those of you who gasped last night, or maybe shuddered a little bit last night, when you saw the news come across that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was in the hospital, let me begin today with two pieces of good news. One is simply that she seems to be okay, reportedly. They're calling it a benign gallbladder infection. And ironically, the COVID-era new normal of the Supreme Court means she will be able to participate in oral arguments today in an important case about birth control by telephone from her hospital bed. Before COVID, I guess she would just have had to miss today's session. That's ironic and interesting. They're all doing it by telephone. That's why she can participate. The other piece of good news for those of you rooting for long life for the resilient RBG, who has beat both pancreatic and colorectal cancer, the second piece of good news is a little more indirect, but get this. The New York Post had an article yesterday about a surprising number of centenarians licking coronavirus. One 104-year-old Brooklyn woman named Ida Acacia Mesa had already survived the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic and cancer and two broken hips before she beat the coronavirus last month. How about that? She survived two pandemics 100 years apart. Another century-old survivor in the article is a former fire dispatcher from the NYFD from Long Island who retired at 95 before besting the bug at more than 100. Another is an Oregon vet who made it through World War II and now COVID-19. So some bright spots for RBG and really for the world amid all the grief and amid perhaps the scandal of our times as it affects the elderly, the failure to regulate nursing homes over many years in ways that could have prevented mass casualties. At least there are some people over 100 who can beat coronavirus and keep going. Okay. One more piece of good news, nothing to do with RBG. The number of new confirmed cases in New York has dropped by half from last week. It was just under 5,000 most days in New York State last week. It was just under 2,500 on Monday, new cases. That doesn't mean it'll keep going down, but it's a sign of hope. Nationally, though, it's another story, and that brings us to our first real segment today, and these controversies over President Trump planning to transform the nature of the coronavirus task force and starting to talk in terms of acceptable numbers of dead Americans to open the economy. You'll remember the president used to boast that the U.S. was beating the original 100,000 death model because it would only be 60,000 because they were doing things so well. But we're now past that 60,000, and the president now admits we may be headed towards six figures after all.
We're going to lose anywhere from 75, 80 to 100,000 people. That's a horrible thing. We shouldn't lose one person over this. This should have been stopped in China. It should have been stopped. But if we didn't do it, the minimum we would have lost is 1,000,000, 2,000,000, 1,000,000, 4,000,000, 5,000. That's the minimum. We would have lost probably higher than, it's possible, higher than 2.2.
The news in there was that he's talking about losing 100,000 people again. So New York is going down. The rest of the country, despite starting from lower numbers than New York, is not. Nationally, we're on a recent plateau of 30,000 new cases a day. That's 200,000 a week, close to 1 million every month. But states with rising virus rates are the ones starting to reopen anyway. And here's the real bombshell clip of this week that's starting to define a new national debate. It's former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. He wants you to accept, in this interview with Dana Bash on CNN, that opening the economy more is worth the price of causing more people to die.
Of course everybody wants to save every life they can. But the question is, towards what end ultimately? Are there ways that we can thread the middle here to allow that there are going to be deaths, and they're going to be deaths no matter what? And if we can do things to keep people in the mode of wearing masks, of wearing gloves, of you know, distancing where appropriate, we've got to let some of these folks get back to work, because if we don't, we're going to destroy the American way of life in these families, and it will be years and years before we can recover.
Chris Christie on CNN. With me now, physician and health policy researcher at the Harvard School of Public Health and director of their Harvard Global Health Institute, Dr. Ashish Jha. He has a blog with a great name. It's called An Ounce of Evidence. In his Twitter bio, he calls himself an advocate for the idea that an ounce of data is worth 1,000 pounds of opinion. And he made news last week and managed to be invited on both MSNBC and Fox, a rare feat, with his article on the health-oriented site Stat News called We Need the Real CDC Back, and We Need It Now. Dr. Jha, it's an honor. Welcome to WNYC.
Brian, thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be on.
30,000 new cases nationally, stuck on that plateau. What do your best ounces of data tell you about why that's happening?
Well, you know, we have really handled this outbreak quite poorly, and we basically wasted months not getting a testing and tracing infrastructure in place. We're still doing a wholly inadequate number of tests. And we have not handled this in a way that evidence and science and data would dictate. And by the way, there's no reason for us to accept that 30,000 is somehow faded or we're going to have to live with that. We have chosen to be here, and I obviously would like for us to choose to act differently moving forward.
I saw that you retweeted a post by your Harvard colleague, Thomas Tsai, that said, as states begin to reopen, this is an important time to reexamine the effectiveness of social distancing. And it looks like he and you partnered with Google to examine mobility data about that. Do you have a top-line result?
I do. I'll give it to you. And it's been out there with some other studies as well, which is that the policies that were implemented around social distancing largely worked. They got people to stay at home, and especially the policies around closing down restaurants and bars. After that, you really saw a very dramatic decline in activity, and people were pretty compliant overall with stay-at-home orders.
So if new cases of the virus are so stubbornly occurring at 30,000 a day nationally, as we mentioned at the top of the segment, are you learning more about ways that people are getting it, that maybe we're not taking enough of the right precautions from the right kinds of social distancing?
So there are a couple of things to think about here, Brian. And at a very, very simple level, it's worth understanding the biology and the dynamics of this disease. The way it works, right, is that the average infected person under normal circumstances is going to infect 3 more people. And those 3 will infect 9 and 27 and 81, and you get this exponential growth. And the only way to prevent that, short of a vaccine, is to make sure that infected people don't come in contact with susceptible people. And so all of our social distancing efforts, the lockdown, et cetera, has managed to stop the exponential growth. We've flattened that growth. That is real progress. But the question is, is this the best we can do? And obviously, I think the answer is no, because the other way you keep infected people away from susceptible people is by having a really robust testing and tracing program where you identify who's infected and you separate them out from people who are not. And if we had done that in conjunction with the social distancing, first of all, I think we'd be in much better shape. And moving forward, as we relax some of these rules, we have to ramp up testing and tracing. Otherwise, the number of cases are going to start going back up, and we're going to start getting exponential growth again. Like, that's just the basic biology and math of this disease. That's not some fancy prediction. That's what's going to happen.
Before we get back to national policy, can I ask you about one controversial aspect of social distancing that I keep getting asked about, and maybe different public health experts have different answers, I'm not sure. But the question is, are runners and cyclists who are not wearing masks a threat to people they pass on the street if they happen to be infected?
Yeah, so, my preference would be that everybody wears a mask outside. Would it be better if those people wear a mask? Sure. But the question is, how big a deal is it? How much transmission is happening because a biker biked past you not wearing a mask? And to be perfectly honest, most of the data says it's probably not that big a deal. So, again, in the ideal world, everybody be wearing a mask, it'd be great. But do I think we should start like yelling and screaming at a biker who goes by without wearing a mask? Like, probably not. It's not, the evidence suggests that that's not how most people are getting it. You're getting it by having proximal contact for some sustained period of time, a few minutes, up to 10 minutes is clearly enough. But the five-second, you know, drive-by, the five-second run-by, I don't think that's a huge deal. And I don't want people to get too upset about it.
You know, you say 10 minutes. You say 10 minutes. Yeah. And that reminds me of another specific question that I've been asked and I don't know the answer to. As people in New York City, many of whom live in apartment buildings, are turning their behavior in their buildings, or transforming, let's say, their behavior in their buildings with building-wide rules and just common courtesy. In a building with an elevator, if I'm getting in after an infected person just got out, let's say, and let's even assume they were wearing a mask and didn't cough or sneeze while they were in the elevator, but everybody in most buildings is being required to wear masks, I support it. But would that person have left droplets that could infect me just from breathing in the elevator or touching the elevator buttons?
So theoretically, yes. In reality, would I feel comfortable getting into an elevator if I knew that the person before me had worn a mask and I'm wearing a mask? You know, I think I would. Now, you know, personally, I'd love to figure out, is there any way to better ventilate that elevator? Probably. I mean, again, I don't know enough about elevators and air ventilation in elevators. But, you know, ideally with all of this stuff, you want to just keep working on finding ways of reducing risk. But I don't see that as a super high-risk activity, walking into an elevator with a mask on where the person previously also had a mask on. If people are not wearing masks, I think you've just raised the risk a bunch. So, you know, again, it's one of those things where if you're looking for complete certainty, the answer is, well, sure, there's a small theoretical risk. If you're looking for realistically, are a lot of people getting sick? I don't think I have any evidence that a lot of people are getting infected that way. And I personally would feel comfortable walking into that elevator.
Your article that got so much attention saying we need the real Centers for Disease Control back, collecting and publishing data about the virus, which for some crazy reason they've been doing with every other disease, but not with coronavirus when we're in the middle of this public health emergency like no one's ever seen. And yet we're hearing these numbers all the time, like the 30,000 new cases a day plateau and everything else. So what's missing? What's the essence of your argument about what we're not getting from the CDC that's so essential?
Yeah. You know, I have, you know, spent my whole life in public health. And Brian, I know you've had your stint in public health as well.
A little bit.
You know, I'm sure you'll agree with this, that the CDC has always been the revered institution, has been the kind of gold standard. And I've probably said 100 times in my life, the greatest public health agency in the world. And no one disputes that. And somehow, in the middle of the greatest pandemic in a century, the CDC has gone AWOL. They have disappeared from the national scene. Like, they've been there, they're doing stuff. But, you know, and not to use too crude a phrase, but this is consistently a day late and a dollar short. Like, everything they've done in this outbreak has been just a bit inadequate. And inadequate enough that it makes them ineffective.
Weren't they partly responsible for the failure in testing at the beginning?
Yes.
I know President Trump gets a lot of criticism for that, deservedly so. But didn't the CDC also fail and even downplay in their own offices, fail to develop an effective vaccine at first, and also downplay what this was going to mean for the country?
Absolutely. So that's where their failures begin in this outbreak, is the U.S. was offered a really effective test by the World Health Organization, developed by a great German virologist, and the CDC refused that test and said, no, we'll build our own. Now, CDC's got a lot of capacity, and they can build their own, so that wasn't necessarily the worst decision. But then they built their own, and it didn't work, and it was contaminated. So the right next thing would have been to immediately say, oh, my God, we've messed up. Let's use the CDC test until we fix our own. Instead, they wasted weeks downplaying their failures, telling people nobody needed testing. And the entire federal government, them, the FDA, the White House, essentially left the country blind and let this disease go from a few cases to hundreds to thousands to tens of thousands, and we weren't testing anybody and we had no idea. And by the time the testing came back online, we realized we had a massive outbreak across the country, and particularly in New York, but in other places as well. And I place that not all on the CDC, but certainly CDC was an important contributor to that debacle.
My guest is Harvard Public Health Professor Dr. Ashish Jha. You know, because I mentioned the elevator question earlier, guess what? Never fails. Our audience is amazing. We have an elevator engineer calling in. So why not? John on the Lower East Side. You're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Dr. Jha. And thank you. Amen, Dr. Jha, everything you've been saying. So, Brian, I manage large buildings. And part of what I manage are also the what they call vertical transportation, elevators and escalators. Mm-hmm. And so with elevators, there is always a natural updraft in buildings, what they call the stack effect. Heat rises. Mm-hmm. So it normally creates this updraft. And so you normally can clear the elevator cab because there's holes at the top, vent holes at the top. And you can normally clear it within about 10, 15 seconds. Just hold the door open a little bit. And then you can step in. And for the most part, you probably have reduced the viral load. Also at the top of the, in the motor rooms, at the top, there's usually also exhaust fans. And so this also helps in the acceleration of getting the air out of the shaft. If people are concerned about that, they can always reach out to their building management. If you ever notice in an elevator, it says, you know, the records, the inspection records are available for inspection at the office. And they usually give you a phone number in the office location. Call them up and ask them about it.
That's great.
Another thing we're also doing, Brian, is we're evaluating coatings that they were using in Singapore, and it looks like it's reducing microbial load on buttons after treated for 3 months. And so we are doing it using a device that will read microbial load. And so the doctor could probably tell you about that. But, you know, we've applied the coating. The viral, microbial load was at like 3,077. And then after about a week, it stayed steady for about 11. And so we're still, this is only 1 week after, so it's supposed to be there for 3 months. We will continue testing, taking swipes of it, sending out to labs to see what's on there. But there might be longer kind of things, you know, strategies we can use to make sure that at least elevators stay safe or other areas where people touch things stay safe, including, you know, the constant disinfecting with these static spray devices, electrostatic spray devices that will coat things and you don't have to sit there and wipe it. There's a lot of those. You've seen those where the Chinese were using them, but a lot of those are made in the U.S. and they are available.
Great. That's all great. Great stuff. John, now you've made
thousands
of contacts are going to happen today between people in New York City buildings and their landlords or co-op or condo boards.
And that's what they're there for.
Where do we get this coding? So, John, thank you. Thank you very much. There's really, why'd you say wow, Dr. Jha?
Oh, my God. That, like, how often do I get to call in and just learn so much? That was terrific. John, thank you so much for that information. You know, I've been thinking about the elevator issue, but again, I'm, you know, as you might imagine, not an expert on elevator ventilation. But that was super helpful and makes me feel better. And I will also encourage people to call their elevator operators and make sure that the elevator is better ventilated. That's great. So thank you, Brian, for that information.
And John, thank you. Our audience is amazing. Everybody's always willing to pitch in with whatever their expertise is. Let me get to the ultimate question, or one of the ultimate questions that Chris Christie dared to ask out loud in the clip we played at the top. How many lives might it be worth sacrificing to the virus in order to have the economy open again for everyone else? Does the question itself horrify you, Dr. Jha, or is it looking hard choices in the eye and naming them?
So the question does not horrify me because it's a dumb question. And I apologize for putting it that way, but that's the wrong question.
That's how Christie himself would put it, by the way.
If I understand.
He would say, that's a dumb question if someone asked him. Anyway, go ahead.
Right. I apologize, and I don't like using words like that, but it is a dumb question, and we are having the wrong debate. About, you know, it's not about is it your money and your life. It's not about do we want the economy back or do we tolerate hundreds of thousands of Americans dying. And let me explain why. Because the bottom line is, imagine we open the economy and we say, you know, we're just going to let people die. It's okay. We don't care. We're going to let people die. What will happen is large numbers of people will start getting sick. Hospitals will start getting filled up. Doctors and nurses will start getting sick. The healthcare system will collapse under the weight of exponential case growth. In that context, tell me who is going to be excited about going out to a restaurant. Tell me about the person who's going to want to go to a crowded bar on a Saturday night. Tell me about the person who's going to want to get on an airplane and go to Disney World. No. The economy it relies on the confidence of people to engage in economic activity. It relies on people feeling safe engaging in economic activity. And if you have massive outbreaks, you are not going to have people engaging in economic activity. There is very good evidence. And so if we play this card of let's just open up and let people die, you can open the restaurants. No one's going to show up. That's the reality.
I wonder if that's even true, though. I mean, look at the beaches in Florida this past weekend. Well, look at even the banks of the Hudson River last week. New York is the epicenter when the Thunderbirds were flying over.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. First of all, I understand there are instances you can put. I'm looking at the data, the national surveys that say most Americans, 80, 90% of Americans do not feel comfortable going out to restaurants, do not feel comfortable getting back to work, unless there's a lot more testing and unless they feel like things are safer.
Right.
Here's the point. I mean, there are some people who are going to do that, and you will see parks getting filled up a bit. But imagine, play that out. Over the next few weeks, over the next month, if we start seeing spikes in cases again, I think people are going to want to go back home and stay safe. So I've always said we've got to find a third path. And we know what that third path is, by the way. This is not rocket science. It is having and I'm going to say this again, like a very robust testing, tracing, isolation system. And people say, well, how do you know that'll work? And I can literally point to half a dozen countries that have done it, and it has worked. South Korea is open. And they don't have people dying. New Zealand is opening up. They don't have people dying. Germany has opened up. They don't have large numbers of people dying. This is not the right set of choices. The right choice is let's do both. Keep our economy going with some modifications. Let's make sure not a lot of people get sick. Few will either way. But let's have both. And we can have both. But we've got to make the choice to have both.
For you as a data-driven public health person, I imagine you would say in normal times that unemployment leads to health problems, including deaths from the things the president has been talking about recently, suicide and addiction, for example. And we know poverty lowers life expectancy in so many ways. So is there any way to have a comparative data, unemployment versus COVID risks that can inform our national public policy discussion about how much to continue the lockdown?
This is not a long-term, the economic hit need not be a long-term economic hit. We can help people who are laid off by providing them with cash assistance, by providing them with ways of getting through this period. We can't bring people who die back. So if I had to choose between unemployment and death, I would choose unemployment, because at least we can help unemployed people get through this time. Not as well as if they had a job, not as well as if the economy was booming, but we can still help people get through it. So that's point number one. Point number two is there is a way out of this. And again, I can point you to places like Germany, which have taken an economic hit, but not as big as ours. South Korea, not as big as an economic hit, and far fewer deaths. So I keep wanting to come back to, let's not set up the false choice of, do you want unemployment or do you want death? How about a little unemployment, but we help people who are unemployed, very little death, and a middle ground where we can keep most of our economy going? It is possible. Lots of countries are doing it. We don't spend enough time talking about the solution. We have set up this false choice and say, which of these two terrible choices do we want? I don't want either.
Physician and health policy researcher at the Harvard School of Public Health and director of their Harvard Global Health Institute. And if you go to his Twitter feed, I don't have it in front of me, but you nicknamed yourself something like Dr. Ashish, give us back the CDC, Ja, right?
I did. Yeah, my Twitter handle is Ashish Kejha, and about every week or two, I add a little thing to my Twitter handle, mostly to kind of reflect what am I thinking about and what am I worried about this week. So I've been focused on testing for a long time, but last week I switched it to I want my CDC back.
This was great. Thanks so much for joining us. Hope we can have you back.
That'd be great. Nice chatting with you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, A Daily Politics Podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.